Hi, my name is Monica, and I'm a compulsive eater and restrictor. And a compulsive exerciser, and a body obsessor, and an orthorexic. Thank you, Atisa, for asking me to lead the meeting. I led this meeting a couple years ago, and I was like completely racked with nerves over it, and because it was such a long share, and also because it was being recorded, and then it never ended up, I don't know if it was recorded or not, but it never ended up making it, so like, I have to do it again, like I'm going through that again now. But I love these podcasts. I love these meetings. This one and the other one tonight have the podcast. When I first came into the rooms, which was just over 5 years ago, I was going to a ton of meetings where I was also supplementing that with so many podcasts. I listened to probably 3 podcasts a day at the time, and it was just like, I needed to hear the message all day long. So I'm really grateful they exist. I'm really grateful to like be able to contribute to that in some way. So I'm just going to do the what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now as best I can. I'm going to start by sending around 2 pictures. One from when I was probably at my highest weight or close to, and the other when I was at my lowest. And it's actually not so much for you guys. I'm sending it around for me because I still have, but it's gotten a lot better, shame around the fact that I was maybe 40, 45 pounds more than I am now, and that, and I have shame that I'm not anymore 20, 25 pounds less than I was. And so I thought a couple years ago when I put those pictures together that they were kind of the ends of my disease, and my story existed in the middle, so all I had to do was like get up here and tell you guys what happened in the middle. And the truth is that those bookends are my disease and my recovery is in the middle, and I didn't learn that until a little bit ways in. So I come from a family of addicts on my dad's side and Italians on my mom's side. So looking back with a little bit of perspective, I feel like I probably didn't stand too much of a chance, but I don't think I was born with this disease. I know that's a lot of people's story. I think that I was born with, or early on I came into, an inordinate amount of fear and anxiety. And what I found was the food, and that was the first thing that I had access to, and thank God for that. My brother found drugs and ultimately heroin, and like that's a much rougher road. So I'm, you know, the thing that we find saves us until it doesn't work anymore, and that's my case. That's the case for me for sure, and I'm really grateful for it. And I didn't really, the disease didn't sink as deep into me until probably when I was about 11 years old is when I can trace back the like the beginnings of like signs of it. And it started probably with restricting. I was always an active, average weight kid. And I never really thought about my body much. And then when I was about 11, a few things happened in my family that sort of shook the stability of our family. And I think that started to manifest in a couple of like OCD tics. And then this idea that I got in reading a magazine article to start giving up drinking soda. For not health reasons, it was like a religious suggestion. And so I was like, that's interesting. I wonder if I could do that. And I did. And I felt really like superior about it. I felt like that made me like better than all the people that were like so weak and drink soda all the time. For the record, to this day, I still don't do that. But it started the pendulum swinging. And I don't know, you know, I don't know if it would have happened anyway. I'm sure that it probably would have, but this disease has always been the pendulum for me, so I would restrict, and then I couldn't do that anymore. My body would physically give out, or mentally I wasn't, like, I thought strong enough to continue that, and so I would give that up and go completely in the opposite direction. I would eat whatever I wanted to, and I would not exercise at all. And, you know, initially it was a very small little swing, and it was probably pretty unnoticeable. I was an athlete growing up. I was a competitive figure skater through high school. And I was very clear by the time I got into my teens that I thought if it wasn't for the figure skating and like my understanding that I had to be feeding my body in order to have the energy to be performing in the way that I wanted to, that I would have a full-blown eating disorder, because that was the only thing that I loved more than I hated myself. And so, you know, I played with food, and then I would go one way and then I would come the other. And what I noticed is that the extremes would just get bigger. And so when I went to college, you know, I gained a lot. I like was very specific about I'm not going to gain the freshman 15. And so I was like diligent about like eating carefully and working out. And then I didn't, but then my sophomore year I gained like 40 pounds probably. And so like I just kept doing that back and forth until I moved out to Los Angeles about 11 years ago. And, you know, I came out here and I had an image of what it looked like to live in Los Angeles and what your body was expected to look like. And mine did not look that way. And at a certain point, after living out here for maybe a year, I was like, okay, I'm done. For real, like, this is the last time. I'm going to do a commercial diet, which I'd never done before. I'd never said the word diet in my life. I found it incredibly shameful to in any way admit that I was unhappy with my body, even though that was completely driving almost all of my decisions in my life at that point. I felt like it was just, like, too vulnerable to, like, let anyone else in on how much that bothered me. So I know I've heard stories of people, like, putting a picture of themselves when they're overweight on their refrigerator and, like, to remind themselves not to eat. But, like, the idea of acknowledging it in any way was too much for me. Like, I was not willing to do that. So I very quietly did this online diet program where you count points. And I was really good at it. And it, like, clicked, you know, like a certain OCD thing in my brain where it's, like, counting and, like, calculating and, like, compartmentalizing good and bad and black and white and exercising and balancing it out. And, like, I lost 50 pounds over the course of, I don't know, what would have been a healthy amount of time for that. And then I was actually in a body that I felt good about, but my life was incredibly small. It was all it was counting and exercising. I had a job that had me sitting at a desk all day long, which creatively I'm a writer. It was not a job that was a writing job, but I could have been using that time to do that as much as I wanted to, but instead I was, like, looking up diet suggestions and, like, superfoods and, like, adding things up. And I knew that at that point I was the thinnest I'd ever been, and the voice in the back of my head was, like, this is going to swing back in the other direction, and every time it swings back it's bigger, and I cannot handle when it gets bigger. Like this swing is going to be too big for me to, like, sustain. And so even though I knew that, I was powerless to change any of it. And so what happened was I was, it was December of about 6 years ago, and my job that I was at, that I'd been at since I moved out to Los Angeles, ended fairly abruptly, and my brother died from the heroin addiction the next, like, that, the job ended up Friday, and he died on a Monday, and it was right before Christmas. And that wasn't enough yet. So I was in the midst of training for a marathon, and that was my solution. Like, that was my best thinking, was that, like, well, I can run this off. And so that was December, and I was training for this marathon, which was going to be in April, and in January I got injured. And I trained through the injury. I couldn't walk without limping, so I swam to finish my training. And then the marathon was in April, and I hadn't run in 2 months, and I ran it anyway. And I finished it, and I was not able to run after that for years. I had to go through physical therapy and all the things, and I had the distinction, which I'm sure I'm not alone in these rooms, of even in the course of a training for a marathon, I managed to gain weight. So my first priority once I completed the marathon was to lose that weight, and so I finally sought out a nutritionist, which, because that's the obvious solution in my brain. And she was amazing, and she was a holistic nutritionist, so she really kind of addressed the broader issues. But I was so focused on the food, I was like, no, just tell me how to lose the weight. And I was vegetarian, I was vegan at the time, and I also had a number of restrictions that I put on myself on top of that because of the way this disease works in my brain. And so I gave her all of these things, and I was like, I'm eating compulsively, and I was using the word compulsively even though I wasn't here yet. I understood that this was something that I was not in control of, and helped me. And so she gave me a meal plan for the week that took into consideration all of my restrictions, and she was like, this is enough food for you. And if you find that you eat this and you are still eating things outside of this, this might be a bigger problem, and we might need to go somewhere else for help. And she went to therapy. And I was not ready to deal with that yet because finding a therapist sounded impossible to me. And so I was like, well, I'll just stick to the diet. I can stick to the diet. That's what I always do. So I went into the week, and I stuck to the diet for like 3 days. The food plan for 3 days. And then on the third day, I was at work, and I found myself in the kitchen, like, eating cookies. And I was like, oh, I can't do this. I'm powerless over this. And so I went back to my office, And I searched OA because I knew that it existed. For some reason, I don't know why I knew that. And I had searched out meetings twice before when things got pretty dark and I was feeling really powerless over the eating. Usually late at night, I would like Google the program and like look for meetings, and then the next day I would never do anything about it. So that day I Googled meetings, and there was a Wednesday night meeting in the part of town that I worked in, and so I left my office when the day was over and I went straight to that meeting. And that was my first meeting, and I haven't left the program since. And the meeting that I walked into, thank God that it existed, and thank God that they were so welcoming to me, and it was not necessarily what I needed to hear that night. I didn't feel like I fit into that room. I didn't see people that I related to. I didn't actually hear all that much recovery in that room or anything that I related to so much that I was like, oh, I belong here, but I had no other options. And what I did hear that was the thing that I took away from that meeting was, go to 6 different meetings before you decide if this program is for you. And so the entirety of the meeting, I remember that I was sitting there thinking what candy bar I was going to go to the store and get after the meeting ended. And then I got in my car and I left and I went home and I didn't stop to get a candy bar. And I was like, that is not what my plan was for tonight. So there was something to that. And there was a meeting in my neighborhood the next morning at 7:30, and so I went to that meeting. And that was it was not an AB-focused meeting, but there was a lot of people with that story, and it was something that I understood because that's really where the bulk of this disease has come from for me. And so I was like, oh, I belong here. I got my people, and I felt that I belonged. And so, you know, early on I heard get a sponsor, work with steps, and I didn't know what any of that really meant. I understood what it meant to get a sponsor, but I didn't know how you found someone. And so what I did was I just kept going to meetings. I heard someone in some meeting threw out the idea of 30 meetings in 30 days, so I did that. I don't know if this is like, if you're supposed to do one every day, that's not what I heard. So I just like, I got 30 days and I can get to 30 meetings, and some days I can't get to one and some days I can get to 3. So like, it balanced out. So I wasn't like so perfectionistic about it, which I think saved me. And 30 and 30 turned into 90 and 90 in my first year, and then later in the year I did it again because it was just what I could do. And the gift of what my life looked like when I came into the rooms was that it was so small, and it was, you know, I had a job and I had friends, but they weren't filling me up really, and I had this disease, and so I was exercising and eating and not doing a lot else. And so when I came into the rooms, I had a lot of space in my life to fill it with program. So I did a lot of meetings. And I got to the point where I started to like call myself abstinent because now I was back onto eating perfectly is the way that I defined it. And I was like, well, that must mean that I'm abstinent. I never actually defined my abstinence, but I was like, so I must be abstinent. And so I started working with a sponsor, who, you know, I have great stories about sponsors because my first sponsor that I met, I was like looking for the perfect sponsor, and, which is basically like, me but skinny in my, like, that's like basically what it boiled down to was like me but skinny. And I went to a meeting that I don't normally go to, and this woman shared that I'd never seen before. And then the next meeting I went to the next day, she shared at the same meeting. And then the third meeting that week, she shared at the meeting. And I'd never seen her before. And the only thing I remember her sharing about was how much she liked to sponsor and how much of a big part of her program was. I was like, all right, I got it. Like the third time I got it. So I started working with her. And we worked together for about a year, and I was very proactive about my steps. I just wanted to like get through them and like get the program. And I wasn't in the mentality of like graduating or leaving, but I was like, I heard that the recovery was in the steps, and I heard the promises. And the promises were the only reason I kept coming back to these rooms, because I will stick around for like to see something come true. If you tell me I'm going to get something, I will do what I need to do to get it. So I started working in the steps with her, and I was absent, then I was not absent, then I was absent, then I was not absent. I did that for a year. I just was like, I cobbled together 30 days and 60 days, and, you know, I would take trips over at the Light a Candle meeting on Saturday nights. And then I got to, like, 90 days, and then I relapsed. And then I got to, like, 6 months the second time, and then I relapsed. All while I'm working the steps, thank you. And I had to call, my sponsor had me doing an AEIOU check-in in the evenings, and so there was a long period of time where I would call her and I would say, you know, I'm not abstinent. And just like every day I was calling her, I'm like, I'm not abstinent, and it was really frustrating because I was doing everything that I was being told to do. And over the course of that year, we got through up to the eighth step, and I turned over my eighth step to her, and by that point, I was what I would now say is in relapse. I had no serenity around food. I was gaining weight, and I was really frustrated with the way it looked in my life. And my gut was telling me it was time to change sponsors because I wasn't really getting what I was needing. But my head, which is diseased and not always giving me the best direction, told me to just stick it out and, like, power through the steps with this one, and then I could switch because I did not want to start the steps over again. And I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks later, after I'd, like, made this decision of, like, I'm just going to stick it out, my sponsor called me and said, I'm moving out of the country. So you're going to have to find someone to start working with. And at that point, the next exact right person showed up in my life, and I started working with her, and she spoke to her sponsor about my situation. I didn't want to start the steps over, but I was in relapse, and she came back to me with the direction that I should start back at step one. And at that point, I was desperate enough to do whatever she said because I wanted what she had, and I didn't care anymore. And I've had the gift of having three sponsors in a row who have shared some version of a story of, I came into the rooms, I got abstinent, I gained 20 pounds, and once I worked the steps, I lost it. And at that point, I already was so uncomfortable in my body that I kind of felt like, okay, well, 20 pounds more, how much more uncomfortable can I be? Like, I was already, like, uncomfortable is uncomfortable, and so I was like, if that's what it's going to take, like, I'm willing to do whatever it takes. I'm willing to gain more weight if that's what I have to do. And so I started the steps again. I turned over my first step to my sponsor, and in reading everything to her, she was like, I would suggest that we add no restricting to your abstinence, because everything had been about what I was, you know, I was not going to binge, I was not going to whatever, and we did not address the restricting side of the disease. And when she said that, I looked back and realized that all the time that I had thought I had been abstinent the previous year, I was just in the restricting side of the disease. And once she said that to me, it, like, opened the window. I was terrified at the idea of that abstinence because that's the one thing I didn't know how to do. I knew how to put stuff down. I was really good at putting stuff down. I did not know how to not do that. But I was like, yeah, I'm willing to do whatever she suggested. And that has been the single most freeing thing of this program that I have done, is giving up the restricting. And because I live in both sides of this disease, for me, on any given day, I could be making a choice from either side of it. And so I have to get really honest with myself and really clear on, like, I'm here for my sanity. So what is the choice that is going to make me be most sane today? If that means eating the sandwich, then I have to eat the sandwich. And if that means that if I eat the sandwich, I'm going to be thinking about it all afternoon, I can't eat the sandwich. I have to be really connected in order to do that. And some days it is easier than others. So I started working the steps again. And what the gift of that was that the first time around I'd done it, I was here and I was honest and I was able to do what I was able to do. And it was, in retrospect, pretty surface level. And that's okay, because that's what I needed to do for that time, just to, like, have someone I could share my story with, but I wasn't actually feeling any of it. And so the next time around, like, we got deeper. And the material was the same, but my emotional experience was very different. I would love to talk about the steps a little bit. I think I've got some time. So my step one experience, you know, I've kind of got, like, little, like, snippets of experiences with each of the steps. And the first meeting I walked into, I would still stand by the notion that I took my first step in step one the first time I walked in the doors of the meeting. Because that was the first time in my life that I admitted that I was powerless over this thing, and I was not going to try to, like, another solution outside, because I just didn't know what it was. And so I really, and the relief of walking into these rooms in a way that I've never experienced in my life before was, like, I walked into this door, and without saying a word, you guys all knew my secret. And, like, I had not had that experience before of, like, I was constantly hiding what I was doing or telling you one thing and doing something else. And so, like, to be transparent in that way, and then to be like, also, I can't fix it, was step one for me. My second step, to finding a higher power, I've done it a few times. I've worked the steps almost twice in this program and almost once through in another program. And so I did the want ad for God, and I did, you know, all the things that were suggested to me, all the reading and writing. And one of the things that was most helpful to me with the second step was that I had this definition of a higher power that worked for me, but I wasn't feeling very connected to it. And I heard someone say that they use an exercise where they write a letter to God in the morning with their hand, with their whatever hand they write with, I'm left-handed, and they write God's response with the opposite hand. And so I was like, I'll try that. And so I tried that, and literally that day, like, it was immediate connection of like, oh, it's that voice in me that I have access to when I tap into it. And like, I was always thinking of God as this external thing, and sometimes I still do, but when I brought it back to the internal and to the like the God voice within myself, I was able to connect really clearly. Step three, very early on in my first year in recovery, I was struggling with the third step, and every night I was going to bed and I was saying the third step prayer. And I was running through all the things I was turning over to God in my head, and I was like, I'll turn over my food, I'll turn over my body, I'll turn over my living situation, I'll turn over, and I would get to work and I couldn't turn it over. I literally felt like I would hit up against a brick wall every time I would get to that one, and I couldn't let it go. I was like, no, God's not going to give me what I want in that, thank you, in that area. If I let it go, I have to like rest control and rest satisfaction in that one. And for weeks, I just kept turning, like trying to turn it over at night, and I couldn't. And literally there was one night where I like got to it and I was like, okay, you can have that too. Like I just like, I exhausted myself trying to do it. And so I was pursuing a career in writing, and I couldn't write anymore. I just, like, I got to the point where I couldn't sit down and make myself do it. And it was terrifying. I had no plan B. I had no alternate course of action, which I think saved me in some ways from, like, becoming, I don't know, something that is not the thing that lights my soul on fire. But I had a conscious moment where I was like, I have to just put it down for now. And if I have the faith that I put this thing aside and focus on my program and on my step work, I believe that I am going to come out on the other side with whatever God's got planned for me, which is probably bigger than I've got for myself. And to condense that story, I put down the writing for probably 2 years, and I really didn't touch it. And sometimes that was really painful for me, and sometimes I beat myself up about it, and sometimes I was just surrendered to the fact that I was powerless. And once I got through a certain point in my steps, it came back. And like, I now have a job in the field that I was pursuing when I came out here. And like, I think it is only a result of doing the work in these rooms. Step four and five are maybe my favorites. Step four felt like my second, fourth step. And I've done it every different way. I've done it out of the big book. I've done it the steps in the 12, or the questions in the 12 and 12. I've done it narratively. I've done it. I mean, there's every way that I've heard someone describe it, I've done it. And it felt like peeling my skin off. And like, I would sit down having to write it, and I just wanted to like throw my books across the room. Like, it was so uncomfortable. Turning over my fifth step, every time I've done it has been one of the most profound experiences of this program for me. And I had a lot of reticence about it, as a lot of people do, because it's something that most people don't do in their normal lives. But I was met with such love and non-judgment when I turned over everything, all these things that I'd been so ashamed about or that I'd forgotten about. That was like truly my first experience of what felt like unconditional love. And if that's not God, I don't know what is. So that opened my eyes. Six, made me want to kill myself. Six, all of my character defects came up and they were active in my life. And like every day they were like, a new one would pop up, in a way that was making me crazy. And I literally turned to my son and said, we have got to get the F out of six because I need to be in seven immediately. So these things can be taken away. And then when I got to my eighth step, you know, it mirrors four in so many ways. And so I had all these things that I was thinking I owed amends for and that I was getting ready to turn over. And I was ashamed of a lot of them. And my eighth step, in reading them, I had enough recovery and I was close enough with my sponsor that like, I read her things that I was ashamed of and we laughed about them. And like, that was like such a progression from my fourth step where I was like crying about this stuff. I was like, oh, this is just stuff that we do. Like, we're just humans. And to have the shame lifted into just people like, you're such a cute little person, was an enormous gift. And then nine, and I'm going to wrap up with this because I think we're about out of time. Nine was so interesting because I've had the experience of not so much stealing, although like I've stolen food from time to time, but like scamming things, like seeing what I could get away with. And that was, everyone has a different reason for doing that, and my sponsor saw clearly through it into the base of almost all of my things I owed amends for was a fear of scarcity. And so the first amends that I made was to myself, and it took a really long time, and it was to act out of abundance towards myself. And so, like, to see that the world is abundant and that my God is abundant, and that, so I was buying gifts for myself. I was getting car washes. I was, like, doing all of these things that, like, rewired my brain to, like, get out of the fear of scarcity. And that's something that I'm still practicing because it's a deep, deep character defect. But it completely shifted the paradigm, and then I was able to go out into the world and make my amends to other people. Would love to talk about the rest of the steps and also about this fellowship and the relationships I got out of it. So if you want to ask me questions about that when we get to that portion, I'd be super happy to talk about it. But thank you for letting me share. This is the time for questions only. There is no sharing at this meeting. If you need to share, please do so with any one of us after the meeting. Also, please remember that the opinions of the leader are my own and not those of Overeaters Anonymous as a whole. When asking questions, you need not identify yourself. Please remember, if you ask a question, your voice may be audible on the OA podcast. Thank you. I was asked to talk about the rest of the steps, and I will do it quickly. 10th step. I just recently worked a formal 10th step, and for the first time, and my sponsor was so excited. She was like, "I love the 10th step. It's such a big part of my program." And so I kind of went into it with, like, a positive bias, which was such a gift. And she suggested maybe 3 or 4 different ways that I could work it, one of which was the AEIOU, which I was familiar with because my original sponsor had me doing that in the evening. So I started with that one because it felt easy. And a lot of the recovery is, for me right now, is that, like, that one worked, so I just stuck with it. I didn't, like, keep pushing myself to, like, try all the other ways. And so at night right now, I do an AEIOU. I don't know if you're not familiar with it. An A stands for abstinence. You just write down yes or no or check in with someone if you're abstinent. E, did I exercise today? I, what did I do for myself? O, what did I do for others? U, what did I uncover? And sometimes Y, which is I think stands for Yahoo. It's like something that I'm grateful for, something that was like a victory or win for the day. The U, what did I uncover, is still the hardest part for me. And also that's like the richest part. That's where if I have to make an amends for the day, that's what comes up. If there's something that I need to write about in a character defect that comes up, that's where that comes up for me. Step 11, that second meeting that I ever went to was an 11th step meeting. So they had a 10-minute meditation at the beginning of the meeting. So very, very early on, I got into somewhat of a meditation practice, which grew a lot over time. And now I have a morning and an evening ritual. I do, I pray. I do the serenity prayer, the third step prayer, and the seventh step prayer. And I do, I say the first 3 steps. And then I have a couple other individual prayers that I'll do. And then I meditate for a different amount of time at the beginning of the day, at the end of the day. My meditation is very fluid. If I get a suggestion about something to meditate on, I'll do that. Sometimes I'll meditate on my breath. Sometimes I'll meditate on... In the mornings, usually I meditate lying down in the snooze position. but, like, it's just an opportunity for me to have conscious contact. Sometimes I'll write. Right now, my sponsor has me reading On Awakening in the morning and writing out a list of all the things that I'm turning over for the day, all the things that I have fear about, which has been incredibly helpful. 11th step. And then, it's not a formal, I guess, 11th step thing, but I've incorporated prayer into my day so much that it's, like, it's such a natural part of my life now in a way that I couldn't have imagined. I grew up in Catholic schools, and I'm not a religious person any longer, but my spiritual life has expanded so much beyond that. And so, like, I was just talking with a friend last night about how it's so weird to me that, like, I'll be talking with a friend from these rooms and be like, "Oh, well, God will handle it." And, like, I'm the kind of person that, like, says that now and believes it is very amusing to me. But it's very true. And so, like, I started recently, I heard a suggestion of saying a prayer before you eat just to, like, have the conscious contact with God. And, like, so I started doing that. I say a prayer when I get into my car, because a couple years ago I had a series of car accidents, and I was like, okay, I'm powerless over this thing, so God's going to take the wheel for me. And then step 12, I'm actually just starting to work it, so I don't have any big stories about 12, but I'll get back to you next time. Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you for your share. Can you expand a little bit on this concept of restrictive eating and what it was like before and how we approached your food before and after?
Yeah, absolutely. The question is to expand upon what my restricting has looked like and what it was looked like before and what it looks like now. For me, restricting has been, I categorically would take like foods and then entire food groups out of my diet for different reasons. I took meat and fish out very early on because I thought they were gross. Like that's like honestly, like I just like lost a taste for them, so I took them out. In doing work around that, that wasn't the entirety of the story. I was in a situation, I was studying abroad in college and feeling probably like I had no control over anything in my life, and that gave me a semblance of control because I knew what I was going to get for food if I didn't eat meat and fish. Then I would take out sugar, and I would take out dairy, and I would just kind of lose food. And so when the restricting got really the most serious, I was probably eating from a list of about 20 foods. And they were, for the most part, things that would have been classified as superfoods. There's, you know, a lot of my eating disorder can be categorized as orthorexia. I don't know if everyone is familiar with that, but it's a short definition is like an unhealthy obsession with being healthy. And so my disease can take anything to the extreme. So I would be eating a lot of green vegetables and not much else. Now what it looks like is that my abstinence is no recreational sugar because that does not work for me. And there's a short list of alcoholic foods that I don't eat. I don't eat nuts by themselves. I don't eat dry cereal. And beyond that, no restricting. So anything that I cannot choose to not eat something for any reason other than that I don't want it. I don't know if that makes sense, but it makes sense in my brain. So I have to get, like I said, really honest about, like, if I eat this cookie, am I going to be thinking about the rest of the day? Or if I don't eat it, am I going to be thinking about the rest of the day? And that's how I determine when am I restricting and when am I just being a human being walking around the world. Because the point of this is for me to be living. And I realized pretty early on, too, that I'm here because I need to learn how to eat sanely. And my spiritual recovery is going to come in that I have to be okay with whatever my body looks like if I'm sane as an eater. So that's where I've done a lot of work. Yeah, the question is, can I talk about my relationship with my sponsor and how I structure it in the course of a week? I've had three different sponsors in this program now, and they've all been pretty similar as far as our interaction in that I have always been proactive about my program, and I've never had the kind of sponsor that says, call me at a certain time or go to this many meetings. That may just be circumstantial. I don't need that. I'm very self-motivated, and when I'm desperate, I will do the work that I need to do. So I've always been someone who's doing my step work and then pushing my sponsor to listen to it, and setting up times to, like, meet and going to a lot of meetings. So with my sponsor, and the way that I also sponsor is just, I've always been told, I'm available, so call me. If you don't get me, leave me a message, and I'll call you back. And that's the same that I do with my sponsees. So I probably speak to my sponsor, if I'm not in the middle of some sort of crisis, once or twice a week. I'll see her at meetings, maybe once or twice a week as well. I have a sponsor in another program as well that I'm in the middle of turning over step work over the phone, so I leave her a message every day right now, and then she'll get back to me if I need her to or not. It's pretty informal as far as day-to-day contact, but always I will meet with my sponsor either in person or we'll set dates over the phone to go over step work if I need to. Thanks. Great. My relationship with God before program and since I've been in program. I was raised Catholic. I went to Catholic school through high school. I went to a Jesuit undergraduate university, so I was surrounded by religion. I was not especially connected to it. And I never had a problem with the idea of God, and so when I came into these rooms, that was not a struggle for me. The idea of something being more powerful than me came very easily. The personal connection came a little bit harder. I had to do a little bit more work about that. And so I had always prayed and on probably a pretty daily basis, and not just when things were bad. I was someone who was just kind of like connected in that way. But I had shame around that for whatever reason. Externally, it's not cool to be someone who prays, or so I thought. And so I didn't really own that in my life. I wouldn't really talk about it at all. And I felt embarrassed that I would do it. Once I got into the rooms and it became clear to me how essential it was and how, like, it was not uncool, it was just a choice, that I became more curious and exploring my spiritual life. And so my relationship with God now, I still do the praying and the meditating, and I have a more personal connection, but I've also expanded my spirituality beyond the bounds of the program. This kind of, like, gave me what I needed to get my food and my body recovery, but I started to experience in one of my second steps that I was doing that my spiritual life was brushing up against the bounds of 12-step. And so that pushed me to explore spirituality and God outside of these rooms, which I would be happy to talk about after the meeting if you would like.
Thank you. The extreme physical discipline you had young, being a competitive figure skater.
Yeah.
Could you talk about how it's been both good for your program and bad for your program? I assume it's been something.
Sure, yeah. How has my extreme discipline as an athlete been both good and bad for my program in recovery? I am not someone who lacks willpower and who lacks will in that for that fact. But so doing the step work, getting to meetings, the routine of it all is very familiar to me, I think, as an athlete, but also just as a personality type. So, like, once I get into routine, it's very easy to stick with it. And in my disease and also just in my regular life, when I break a habit or when I let something go for a day, my fear kicks up and I'm never going to do it again. So I would, if I was training for a competition or for a marathon or something, I would work out every single day. And then if I didn't work out for a day, I was afraid I would never work out again. That's just how, like, it's black or white thinking in my mind. So I can still fall into the pattern of, like, I'm doing step writing every single day, but then I'm afraid if I don't do it today, then I'm never going to do it again. So a lot of my recovery has come in the, like, putting it down and then, like, picking it up the next day after that. So I can see that there is grace in the, like, not being in control of all of it. I had an example also that applied to that. What was it? I lost it. I don't know. Is that okay? Does that answer your question? Thanks. Abby. Thank you. The question was about fellowship and how it works in my program. I'm so glad that you asked that and that I get to talk about it. The fellowship, as in the community of this program, is by far my favorite thing about these rooms. And so I came into the rooms about 5 years ago. I found my home meeting a few months after that. And then somewhere in between, I went to a meeting. You know, it was clear on I needed to be here. And I was clear on the promises and, like, why I would benefit from being here, but I went to a meeting. It was a Sunday morning meeting, and there was a girl that was taking a candle for, I don't know, like 6 years of abstinence at that point. And I didn't really know anyone in the meeting. I was still new. I recognized some of the women there, but not the one taking a candle. And she got up and she said whatever she said, and like I don't know, it felt like 150 women, but there was probably like six of them, got up and gave her candles. And she spoke about them and, like, the friendships that she cultivated and, like, how these women just showed up for her. And it was the first time in these rooms that I saw something that I wanted. I was like, oh, I want that. And, like, that little corner of this program is somewhere that I can make myself comfortable and be at home. And so it was the first time that I had not only the willingness but the, like, wantingness to be here. And so that was really attractive to me. And so when I found my home meeting, it turned out that a lot of those women were at that meeting. So, like, energetically, it was just, you know, a good fit for me. And I've made my, like, I understood the term home meeting once I, like, settled in there, because, like, those people and this program in general, it's like being able to just show up and, like, have the same emotional DNA running through our bodies is so much more of a connection for me than I have with the people that I have physical DNA with, thank you, out in the regular world. You know, and I come from the kind of family where the Italian side at least is like, oh, well, this third cousin of yours that you don't know is going to be in Long Beach, like, you should go see him. And I'm like, why would I ever? Like, I really, like, I have no connection in that regard. But if someone called me and was like, there's a fellow and she's coming in town and you don't know this person, but she needs your help, I would never hesitate to, like, pick up the phone, to, like, pick her up from the airport. Like, it's just like it's a different connection that makes sense to me and the way that I'm emotionally constructed. So I also remember quickly, early on in this program, I had made friends with someone in the rooms who had a lot of time, and I was like, well, who are your friends? And she was like, and she named up a lot of people that were, like, her program friends, and that was kind of like the composition of her life at that point. And in my very early recovery, it sounded so unappealing to me. I was like, it sounds like your life is so small. I don't know that I said that out loud, but I was thinking it. That like, it just felt so limited. And I had all these other friends from like graduate school and, you know, working in Los Angeles that I was like, I don't want to lose that. It's to forfeit it. And now that I'm in these, that I'm as deep in as I am in these rooms, that like, all of my closest friends are from this program. And I still have all of those other people in my life, but, and they still fill the same roles for the most part that they did, but like, you guys just have gotten like, in really close to my heart. And like a level that I didn't know was an option or that existed before. And it touches every part of my life. It touches my work life. It touches, like, I kind of can't turn around in my life without landing on a fellow somewhere, which has been one of the biggest gifts of my recovery too, because I'm surrounded by God. I'm surrounded by Talk of Program. There's always someone I can be honest with about my food or about my brain. And it's the, more than anything else, the thing that has kept me wanting to come back to these rooms. One more question? Yeah.
Thanks for sharing. Can you talk about, so as a writer, your sedentary, long hours, sometimes your triggering environment, can you talk about how you balance between your program and your absence and your serenity, but still being a full-time writer?
Yeah. The question is about being a writer, which can often be a very sedentary job and can sometimes be in triggering environments. How do I balance a program and the serenity of that with the profession? Which is a great question and super relevant. The lifestyle is for sure sedentary. The hours can be unpredictable. The environment can be emotionally triggering depending on the job. It can be disease physically triggering because there's often food everywhere and all the things. The greatest gift, which I had no control over, was that my work environment is filled with fellows from this program and from other programs. And so that was just God giving me a gift of like, I can jump into someone's office at the drop of a hat and have, you know, a 2-minute meeting or a 2-minute check-in. Otherwise, it's been using the time the best that I could. And so, because there are the previous jobs I've worked at that were not with fellows, I had a lot of free time in some of those jobs, and so I was able to do step work. So it was like finding the spaces for God, finding where in my life I could fit in meetings or where I can make outreach calls. If I had a long commute, I was on the phone the whole time calling fellows. Texting is like such a gift for me and for all of us right now, in that like we can almost always get away with shooting a text, and like even if we can't wait for the response, coming back to a phone with a bunch of responses to it. And I can always check in with my higher power. So even if it's running to the bathroom and getting on my knees and like saying a quick prayer, stepping outside and taking a walk around the lot, I do all of those things. But I think that also knowing where in my life I have space, and I'm lucky that I do. Some people's lives are so full that they don't have anywhere. But I know that my mornings are sacred. Like I know that I have a certain amount of time before I walk into the office that I can do whatever I want with. And so even if I might be there all night, I can get to a meeting or I could do my step writing in the morning so I can start the foundation for the day right. Yeah, that's the best idea. Thank you. Thank you for letting me share.